Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Wednesday, April 17, 2013. Suspicious packages sent to President Obama and three United States senators.
Return to sender. Return to sender. I gave a letter to the postman. He put it in his sack.
It included a little ricin.
Bright and early next morning. He brought my letter back.
She wrote upon it.
Return to sender. Address unknown.
Thank you, Evis. You can leave the building now.
No such number. No such song.
Reminiscent of the anthrax letters that arrived at Democratic senators' offices and a few other locations after the 9/11 attacks, following the Boston Marathon bombing, we find the White House and three U.S. senators reporting suspicious packages, and the FBI confirms that a letter addressed to the president appeared to contain the poison ricin, R-I-C-I-N. Also, a letter addressed to Senator Roger Wicker, Republican of Mississippi, arrived on Tuesday and tested positive for ricin. They say that letter addressed to the president had similar markings and was similar in appearance to the one addressed to Senator Wicker, and they think that the same person is responsible. The letters contained a granular substance that preliminarily tested positive for ricin. And separately, we understand that Alabama Senator Richard Shelby has received a suspicious letter that caused a clearing of the Hart Senate office building on Wednesday morning, and a report that is undetailed that Senator Carl Levin of Michigan received what is simply known as a suspicious package at his Senate office in Saginaw, Michigan. So we'll follow this and see where it leads. Meanwhile, in Boston, there are reports that they may be zeroing in on a suspect, but CNN jumped the gun on reporting an actual identification, and so far I have no other details to report at this moment. In Washington today, activity in the United States Senate, and a double cross for the president and Democrats who accepted a compromise bipartisan proposal from Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Senator Pat Toomey, a Republican of Pennsylvania. And because they failed to fix the filibuster back at the beginning of the session, this vote was a majority vote, 54, but it didn't meet the 60-vote threshold needed to overcome the arcane Senate rules. And there was some maneuvering going on. John McCain threw his support behind the bill, but it was conservative Democrats, including Begich of Alaska, Baucus of Montana, and a couple of others, who enabled the Republicans and the gun lobby to defeat this bill. Now, this bill would have expanded background checks, but it was nowhere near universal. And I'm not opposed to background checks and the expansion of them in any way. But this bill was so watered down already. It actually imposed penalties if the data from the background checks were assembled into some sort of a national gun registry. And so what good is a background check if you can't build a database on the people whose backgrounds you're checking? There are many other problems with this bill, but the fundamental double cross is that Joe Manchin, who used a gun in one of his campaign spots when he shifted from governor of West Virginia to the Senate seat that had once been occupied by Robert Byrd, he had the NRA representatives at the so-called negotiating table as he and Toomey watered down this bill. And then the NRA double-crossed Manchin and the Democrats. And I first found out about this vote in the Senate when I was emailed a statement from the NRA, how lucky I am to be on their press list. And it reads, today, the misguided Manchin-Toomey-Schumer proposal failed in the U.S. Senate. Now, this is interesting. They're tagging Chuck Schumer with it, and he supported it, but it was Toomey and Manchin who put it together. The statement goes on. This amendment would have criminalized certain private transfers of firearms between honest citizens, requiring lifelong friends, neighbors, and some family members to get government approval to exercise a fundamental right or face prosecution. Well, the gun lobby is running the game in Washington. This is very clear. And when you listen, and maybe you don't, but I spend a few minutes each day pushing the buttons on my car radio to sample right-wing radio, and even in the liberal Bay Area, we have much more right-wing than anything else. And their themes are the same. Liberal gun grabbers. That's who they blame for all this. And they're absolutely apoplectic about minor changes in gun registration rules and gun laws that would in no way undermine the Second Amendment. But they then talk about this as a broad assault on the Bill of Rights. And I might actually be able to support some of the fears of gun owners and gun lobby activists about big government knowing who's got the guns and how many, if they cared about the other elements in the Bill of Rights, too. And they don't seem to have any concern whatsoever for the rollbacks of the Fourth and Fifth Amendments, the massive surveillance program that continues, the denial of constitutional rights to due process, even to American citizens in the drone program. No, you don't hear about these gun nuts complaining about that. It's only guns. So after the vote, the president held a news conference with some of the Newtown shooting victims and Gabby Giffords, the former congresswoman from Arizona who was shot. And the president said, all in all, this was a pretty shameful day for Washington. He said Republicans and some Democrats caved to the pressure from what he called a vocal minority of people who support gun rights. He said that there were no coherent arguments as to why we wouldn't do this. It came down to politics. And the president concluded his statement by saying, I'm assuming that our expressions of grief and our commitment to do something different to prevent these things from happening are not empty words. I believe we're going to be able to get this done. Sooner or later, we're going to get this right. Well, I appreciate the president's intentions. But Harry Reid did not offer leadership on gun legislation. He made it very clear that he wouldn't support an assault weapons ban championed by conservative California Senator Dianne Feinstein. And while he did support the Manchin-Toomey bill, and he said that he was personally going to vote for the assault weapons amendment, it's very clear that the Senate is locked up. And it's either the power of the NRA or the fear that it instills in senators who are up for re-election, especially next year in 2014. That gives them their tremendous power. They don't even have to wave their guns around. And here's an interesting poll, and I first heard about this when I spent 5 minutes listening to Rusty Limbaugh this morning. And he pointed out that a new Gallup poll, which asked Americans, what do you think is the most important problem facing the country today? Guns and gun control is cited by only 4%. Of the people who responded. Now, to be fair, a lot of important issues only get 4%. Immigration, education, North Korea, welfare 2%, poverty 2%. But Limbaugh got his jockeys all twisted up, saying that this is a missed opportunity for Republicans. That since people say they don't care about gun control, that Republicans should be taking advantage of that inattention or lack of interest. And I find that very interesting and quite revealing about the lengths that they will go to try to attract support from different voter groups. It is remarkable. Progressive filmmaker Robert Greenwald has released a new documentary. I haven't seen it yet, but I'm looking forward to getting a copy and inviting Mr. Greenwald back on our program. His new film is War on Whistleblowers, subtitled Free Press and the National Security State, and in it he profiles four of the recent whistleblower cases. And I give him a lot of credit for the work that he has done over the years. One of the people he profiles is Thomas Drake, and I'm scheduled to interview Tom Drake later today for a package that we'll release here tomorrow at peterbcollins.com. And dare I say, to toot my own horn, it's a blockbuster. This is a conversation with two of the members of the so-called NSA 4. We spoke with Bill Binney, who worked at the NSA for more than 30 years, and with Tim Shorrock, who is a journalist who writes for The Nation magazine. We recorded their comments previously, and we'll add Tom Drake's to them and release that podcast tomorrow. Here is an excerpt from Bill Binney's comments about why he quit the NSA as the outlines of a creeping police state became very clear to him and several other colleagues.
To me, it was really discouraging to see our Constitution being so violated. That was really so disturbing. I couldn't have any part of that. That's why I left NSA, as well as Ed Loomis and Kirk Wiebe joined me, and we all just couldn't stay there and be associated with such a criminal act. So we had to leave, mm-hmm. And that's when we all tried to talk to other people in the government and get them to try to openly address these issues so that they could change and become and try to change that entire process to make it more constitutionally acceptable. Instead, they kept going on the dark side, which, by the way, they never had to do from the beginning, because we had no problem whatsoever identifying terrorists or anybody else that was doing some kind of malicious activity on the net.
Mm-hmm.
We had zero activity. We had zero difficulty doing that. They went to the dark side because they wanted to. That's what happened.
You can hear the full interview with Bill Binney and Tim Shorrock, and hopefully with Tom Drake included, and that'll be released tomorrow at peterbcollins.com. If you want to get more information and order a free DVD of Robert Greenwald's War on Whistleblowers, they have a website set up for you at waronwhistleblowers.com. That's waronwhistleblowers.com. Also in the Senate, they've been hashing over immigration legislation, and they're declaring that they do have a package. And it's even supported by Marco Rubio of Florida. Get that man some water, will you? This is another charade coming from the U.S. Senate. Because while it does create a path to citizenship, that path is 13 years long. And frankly, I find that excessive. It also, as I've pointed out in previous comments, is a big giveaway to high-tech firms in Silicon Valley and other employers who use lower-paid non-Americans under the H-1B visa program. And under this bill, the limit of H-1B visas annually will be almost doubled, from 65,000 to 110,000 per year. And as many as 180,000 could be available eventually. There's a formula that would kick in. And in addition, there are another 25,000 visas, which is a modest increase from 20,000, would go to workers who hold an advanced degree from an American university. And this is a huge giveaway to employers who are giving these jobs to non-Americans at a time when there are many qualified Americans who would love the work. But we know that foreigners can be forced to work for lower wages, and they do. According to Ross Eisenbray, vice president of the Economic Policy Institute, more than half of H-1B workers are paid at the lowest wage tier for their fields. And one of the things they built into this that is a part of the chicanery is so-called penalties for employers whose workforces are composed of 30 to 50% H-1B workers. They would have to pay a fee of $5,000 per visa and it would rise to $10,000 for companies whose workforces are half or more of the H-1B and a similar category. Well, that is a pittance, even at $10,000 a head. They're saving a lot of money as compared to what they would pay competitive Americans. And so it's likely that this bill will go through, mostly because the Republicans recognize that they are hurting themselves with their strong anti-immigrant posture. And it was interesting, in that period of time I was listening to Little Rushbo, every time he mentioned immigration, he used the word amnesty. And that's the red-hot trigger word that Republicans have used to wolf whistle, to silently whistle their supporters into a hateful response. And it's interesting because the Republicans in Washington so far have not dropped the A-bomb, not nearly as much as they did back in 2007. And Rush seems to be out there a little desperate, trying to get his followers to actually follow him. Another important issue related to immigrants, and particularly those who are ordered to be deported, but end up locked up in one of these for-profit prisons, sometimes for months, sometimes for years. And our immigration detention facilities are a black hole. If you're sent there, you've been disappeared. You won't be able to contact your family members. Getting an attorney is extremely difficult, and most of the people sent there don't have the resources or the skills or the knowledge of the American legal system to properly defend themselves. Well, the formerly liberal Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, based here in San Francisco, in a unanimous decision from a three-judge panel, has ruled that the United States cannot hold an immigrant set for deportation for more than 6 months without a hearing. The court rejected the Obama administration's argument that federal law allows indefinite detention. Contrary to the government's rhetoric, said the ruling, this will not flood our streets with fearsome criminals. There are almost 500,000 detainees held in federal custody at any given time, about 33,000 on any particular day. And the underlying ruling that was upheld by the appeals court has produced a positive result because in Los Angeles, where this ruling came from, more than 400 hearings have been held since this took effect last November, and two-thirds of those people have been released on bond. That's kind of encouraging, frankly. The Senate, while you think they're all wrapped up in gun debates and immigration debates, they manage to kiss up to Israel frequently. Item, Senate Resolution 65, introduced by Senator Bob Menendez of New Jersey and Lindsey Graham of South Carolina. And it has all kinds of boilerplate language about how great Israel is, honoring its 65th anniversary. Then, it goes into 14 clauses condemning Iran, with citations from President Ahmadinejad, his ugly language about Israel, his Holocaust denials, yada, yada, yada. Then there are 13 clauses citing President Obama's repeated promises not to permit Iran to attain a nuclear weapon. And then the action clause. If the government of Israel is compelled to take military action in legitimate self-defense against Iran's nuclear weapons, the United States government should stand with Israel and provide, in accordance with U.S. law and constitutional responsibility of Congress to authorize the use of military force, diplomatic, military, and economic support to the government of Israel. So, let's be really clear. If Israel attacks Iran, we are committed to be a part of that madness, to engage in that conflict. This is very dangerous subordination of American foreign policy to the interests of the state of Israel. And this baby is going to pass. It has 79 co-sponsors. It's painful. And then item two is my Senator Barbara Boxer from California doing the bidding of AIPAC, the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee, and introducing a bill that on the face of it seems fair. It basically would allow Israel to become part of a visa-free program. Israeli citizens could come to the United States without a visa. The problem is, as Glenn Greenwald points out in a recent column in The Guardian in Britain, that some U.S. citizens holding Israeli nationality, possessing a Palestinian identity card, or an Arab or of Arab or Muslim origin, have experienced significant difficulties in entering or exiting Israel or the West Bank. And so we would be enabling the discrimination that Israel practices in its own immigration and visa programs. But that's okay, because it's Israel, they're special, and AIPAC wants it done. There's a bill circulating in the House of Representatives that even the White House thinks is a dangerous assault on our privacy rights. That's breathtaking, friends. It's called CISPA, C-I-S-P-A, the Cyber Intelligence Sharing and Protection Act, and it grants broad legal immunity to companies that share individuals' personal information with the government by specifically overriding existing privacy laws. The phrase, notwithstanding any other provision of law, appears repeatedly throughout the text, meaning that this supersedes existing law. It overrides it. Information can be handed over without subpoenas, warrants, or any legal oversight as long as it relates to, quote, cyber threat information, end quote, a vague term with few meaningful limits in the bill. Companies would also face no requirement to strip out personal identifiable details, even when the person in question bears no connection to any purported security threat. And an amendment to remove identifiable details died in committee. So, this is the first time I have been able to praise the Obama administration for trying to protect our privacy rights and prevent unlawful surveillance and release of our information. This is something worthy of praise, because this administration hasn't seen a wiretapping or other surveillance program that it didn't love and want to embed in the law and precedents even more than the Bush administration did. So hopefully the veto threat from the Obama White House will send a message and Congress will table CISPA. In yesterday's news and comment, I spent a few moments talking about the rogue public utility here in Northern California, Pacific Gas and Electric, and how they saved $50 million in the 3 years prior to the gas pipeline explosion in San Bruno, California, that killed 8 people, devastated more than 30 homes. And I give our San Francisco Chronicle, which is a get-along, go-along, pro-corporate, increasingly conservative paper, but in a front-page story today, they report on a study of the Public Utilities Commission. The study concludes that the PUC has an overly cozy relationship with the utilities it regulates and fosters a lackadaisical culture that discourages tough enforcement and fines. Now, what really got me was the headline on this story. It says, PUC top concern is low rates, not safety, comma, execs say. Well, that is a hoot. We pay some of the highest electric rates in the country. And it's because the PUC, and ultimately the bankruptcy court, permitted PG&E to soak the ratepayers for their blunders and cost overruns in building the twin reactor nuke plant at Diablo Canyon in the 1980s. And so their concern about low rates is non-existent. And if safety falls below their interest in low rates, Well, that shows you what kind of problems we have here in terms of public safety with a rogue utility in California. The report says, for example, several respondents report that both commissioners and PUC staff members have close ties to the industries that they are supposed to be regulating. This has resulted in reluctance on the part of commissioners and the PUC to impose significant fines and other consequences. And that's a really pretty way of saying that the regulators are in the pockets of the industry that they are charged with overseeing. And finally today, much of the hysteria coming from the traditionalists who oppose same-sex marriage, marriage equality, these are the proponents of Proposition 8, which is before the Supreme Court right now. They say, well, you know, if you lift the old definition of marriage, one man and one woman, then you're going to have all kinds of couplings that people don't expect. And it could lead to incest. Well, I hope that the Bible thumpers and others who are so fearful of marriage equality will pay attention to a state appeals court here in California that upheld criminal laws against incest. And this is a case that may make you squirm a little bit, okay? And I apologize if that's the case. But a 38-year-old man from Contra Costa County, just east of San Francisco, was convicted of having sex with his 36-year-old sister. And this is a guy who has a history of sexual offenses, a previous rape conviction as a juvenile. And he claims he went to visit his sister and her husband. They drank beer. They smoked weed. The husband went to bed. And then the sister said she woke up to find a man in her bed. At first she thought it was her husband, then realized it was her brother. She later told her son that her brother had raped her. In May of 2011, a jury acquitted the accused brother of attempted rape, but convicted him of incest and misdemeanor assault. And he drew a sentence of 2 years, 8 months, which he has served. And his appeal said that, the longtime moral disapproval of homosexual conduct should lead to, the same overturning of incest laws. But the appeals court said that recent rulings in California and other states have upheld laws against incest on grounds other than the moral disapproval, such as greatly increased risk of genetic defects in children of siblings. So, Rick Santorum, you can rest easy. Marriage equality will not legalize incest. Not even here in California. Californication. Thanks for listening to my ranting and raving. You can find more at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then. Who cares about the clouds?